I had some difficulty deciding what to preach tonight. A few weeks ago, I mapped out this whole section of Mark's Gospel to show how he has structured it with a number of pairs of similar stories that function as frames within frames within frames to tie his points together. And so tonight's extract about James and John asking for the places of honour alongside Jesus is paired with the earlier story of the disciples squabbling over who was the greatest. And these frames and the story at the centre are all about Jesus completely dismantling all notions of a division between insiders and outsiders. And so having done that a few weeks ago, when I came to look at tonight's readings, I felt like I had already preached on this. So maybe I should look at one of the other readings. But no matter how much I reflected on them, I couldn't get any sense that there was something in them that God wanted me to preach here tonight. It was the gospel story that continued to beckon to me. And after a while, I began to notice an aspect of the way that this side of the frame works that takes it in a slightly different direction to the side we looked at a few weeks ago. And it's an aspect which I think might be helpful to us as we seek to live out our response to what Jesus is teaching. It is, of course, very easy to read this story and jump straight to a criticism of James and John and their request for the seats of honour at the right and left of Jesus. The framing makes their request look even worse than it might otherwise look, because Jesus has just given them all a reminder that jockeying for the positions of honour is not what it's all about. The first will be last and the last first and all that. So this story does make the point again that it is very, very hard for the disciples and thus for us to get our heads around the radical nature of what Jesus is saying. Conventional notions and practices of status and worth and honour and recognition are so deeply ingrained in our thinking and in the structures of the world we live in. It's very difficult to imagine what it would be like to let them go. And most of us at some stage in our workplace or somewhere have felt some resentment over the fact that our worth seems to go unrecognised. Well, some people are better paid and more senior and clearly don't deserve it. It's difficult to imagine what it would be like to not even hold those sorts of scales of merit in our heads. James and John may well have had good reason to believe that their request was not unreasonable. It would seem from the gospel record that they were, in fact, often treated by Jesus as some kind of chosen inner sanctum. They do seem to be leaving Peter out of their request, because it's usually Peter, James and John whenever Jesus is just taking a special chosen few on some special mission. But perhaps we can forgive them that. After all, there are only places left and right to go around, and three won't go into two, and they're brothers after all. So their biggest mistake was perhaps not thinking that they might be the chosen ones, but in what they were thinking about the kind of glory that they thought Jesus was about to enter. This little band is now heading up the road to Jerusalem, and they seem to think that the time has come for Jesus to establish his seat of power and set up his throne and begin to rule from Jerusalem. The hard work is behind them, they suppose. Now is the time for crowns and seats of honour. Can you see the irony with which Mark develops their questions and Jesus' response and then alludes back to it later? Grant us to sit, one at your right hand and one at your left in your glory. Jesus says, to sit at my right hand or my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared. And then a couple of chapters later, Mark writes, and with him they crucified two bandits, one on his right hand and one on his left. This is totally deliberate. If he wasn't trying to make the connection, the gospel writer would have just said they crucified two bandits there at the same time. The spatial arrangement of the crosses is a detail that serves no other purpose than this connection, to underline this point. You want the place of honour on the right and left of Jesus in his glory? Here they are, kept for those for whom they have been prepared. But as easy as it is to be immediately critical of James and John here, that may be something of a trap. Because isn't that exactly what the other 10 disciples do in the story? And in fact, Jesus is not really critical of the request that James and John make. He challenges them about whether they've got what it takes to live up to their request, and he does say that he doesn't have the authority to grant their request, but it's when the other 10 get angry with James and John that Jesus really begins to lay down the law. So perhaps if we're instinctively siding with the 10 against James and John, then we, rather than James and John, are the intended targets of Jesus' rebuke. It seems that perhaps Jesus is recognising something good and worthy in the request. His challenge seems to imply that. Have you got what it takes? Can you live up to what you're asking? Can you drink the cup that I must drink? Striving to be the best, to be number one, is not in itself wrong. If Jesus is calling us to do something, there is nothing wrong with wanting to achieve the honour of doing it to the absolute best of our ability and perhaps even better than anyone else. Remember how the Apostle Paul urges us to outdo one another in showing love and in showing honour to one another? Paul is not afraid to appeal to our competitive instincts and to try and channel them in worthy directions. And it seems that Jesus is being similarly sympathetic here. Reach for the stars by all means. But if you want to be honoured above others, then make sure you are ready to put in the hard work to ensure that you deserve it. And therein often lies the trap. Because while he urges us to be our best, as soon as we get caught up in the need to have that recognised and honoured, we've taken our eyes off the task itself and we've crossed the line into the old ways of seeing these things, the old ways of measuring honour and jockeying for position. So Jesus points to the major sacramental practices of the church's worship as being constant reminders that can help to keep us on track. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or be baptized with the baptism with which I am to be baptized? He asks James and John. And the gospel writer underlines what a big challenge this is when a few pages later he lets us see Jesus on his knees in the Garden of Gethsemane, pleading with his Father to release him, if possible, from the need to drink this cup. When we take the broken bread and drink the cup at this table, at the Lord's table, it's no small thing. Jesus was terrified of drinking this cup himself. And James and John's confidence that they were ready to drink it seems to be only because they failed to comprehend what it meant. Drink this cup and you drink the sufferings of Jesus. Be baptized in this water and you are plunged into the pool of dishonor and betrayal and lonely death. Drink of this cup and you are offering yourself to follow in Jesus' footsteps, weighed down by a cross of hostility and hatred. Be baptized in this pool and you are dying to all conventional expectations of honour and recognition and prestige. We often speak of the suffering and death of Jesus as one of a kind, as unique and unrepeatable, and therefore we don't think of it as an example that we might follow. But in this story, Jesus clearly holds it up as an example to follow. Are you able to drink the cup that I have to drink, or be baptized with the baptism that I am to be baptized with? Are you able to come with me and do as I do, to join me in what I'm doing for the life of the world. And sometimes it's when someone has the courage and integrity to step up and aim to do that, that we get a bit like the ten and get angry and denounce them as presumptuous and ambitious and glory-seeking. But in every celebration of baptism and the Lord's table, we are being challenged and called to do just that, to join Jesus in giving our everything in expressing God's love for the world, in following Jesus in his mission of saving love for the whole world. Jesus is extravagantly forgiving of our stumbling efforts. He is more than willing to indulge some of our James and John-like lapses into one-upmanship as long as we continue to feed from the table and drink from his cup and grow in our capacity to join him in his mission of being a blessing of love and mercy to the whole world. The new human came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Giving one's life as a ransom is certainly no shortcut to power and prestige. If some enemy is holding victims hostage, then offering yourself as a ransom means surrendering yourself into the hostile hands of that enemy. And that is exactly what Jesus does. Finding us held hostage by the vicious cycles of bitterness and hostility and violence, he drinks the bitter cup, handing himself over into their hands that we might be set free. And when any one of us is bold enough and reckless enough to set out to follow him in similarly offering ourselves for the sake of others, a bit of James and John like mixed motives or overblown sense of importance is not going to stop Jesus from affirming us and encouraging us to ignore the 10 naysayers behind us and get out there and give it our best shot. Perhaps that's why the Lord's table is a round table. In the end, there is no right and left. There's always room for one more at the table of glory. Amen.